Well, it's not a bad little turnout for the first meeting in our new venue. Welcome to everybody. Some basic house rules, because there are so many here this evening. Can we try to be disciplined in participating in the discussion? So far as I'm concerned, it's the discussion which is the most important part of the evening. That's where you play your part. And so if you wish to enter a contribution, then wave your hand so I can see it. And you'll forgive me because I don't know everybody's name, though I'll try to remember those that I do or should know. Anyway, our topic this evening is Sheffield Troublemakers. And I'm sure, well, even from my narrow knowledge of Sheffield, because I don't come from here, I'm sure we could keep it going for several evenings. And that's just from the people I know. So, the Sheffield Troublemakers, and our speaker this evening is David Bryce, and his book is just... is there, and I think that they're on sale at the back. And how much are they?
£3. £15.
Yep. £15. That's cheap at the price.
It's below.
It really is. It's less. It's less than the. So without further ado, David, you've got the floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's very good of you to invite me and. Interesting to come along to this first meeting in your new abode. I'm just going to start actually on Weymouth Beach, an unlikely place to start in a talk about Sheffield. George III is taking the air and he sees some children playing in the charge of a nurse, and he asks the nurse in a very benevolent way, "Whose children are these?" And the nurse replies, "May it please your majesty, they're Mr. Shaw's of Norton near Sheffield." And at that point, the whole atmosphere changes. The king's countenance darkens and he exclaims, "Ah, Sheffield, Sheffield, damned bad place, Sheffield." Now, if you'd carried out interviews with... his leading ministers at the time, they would all have agreed with the king. Sheffield had a terrible reputation for radical agitation. And this radical tradition, which I think really got going in a big way in the 1790s, has carried on with fits and starts ever since. There are some seats at the front if people are... and my book... describes various people who were leading troublemakers over 200 years. And I'm going to start with the period of the French Revolution. I can't cover everything. I will talk a bit about the Chartist period, talk about Edward Carpenter, about the suffragettes, about Labour coming to power, and about the 1980s. And from your point of view as a humanist association, I think some of these people are particularly interesting. I would single out Isaac Ironside, the remarkable leader of the Democrats on the council in the middle of the 19th century, and Edward Carpenter. Now, if we take ourselves back to the 1790s, Sheffield was a middling-sized town with 33,000 inhabitants, and probably the remains of the castle were still evident, although it had been pulled down by Parliament at the time after the Civil War. And it stretched roughly from Gibraltar Street in the north, Division Street in the west. The moor is somewhere down here. And the wicker you can see there. and that's where the station now is. So that was roughly what it was like, a very crowded town, already the leading cutlery town in Britain. But why was it so receptive to revolutionary ideas? And I've put forward three possible reasons. One was that it was not controlled by a powerful town corporation, like, for instance, Doncaster, or by a powerful aristocrat. It had a lord of the manor, the Duke of Norfolk, but he was an absentee. He had an agent in the town, but he did not control the town. And the second factor was radical dissent. The middle classes were predominantly dissenters, and the Church of England was relatively weak. The most influential congregation was the Unitarians at Upper Chapel. Show the next slide, David. Do we want to... I don't know what you want to, whether you want to sit down on the floor in the front, or you're all right there. Okay. And the minister at the Upper Chapel at this time was a remarkable character called the Reverend Joseph Evans, who was there for 40 years, and it was during his time that the church moved from being Presbyterian to Unitarian. If you turn the next slide. This is Joseph Evans. And he's holding a book, and you may think that the book is the Bible, but it is not. Show next slide. You can just see that the word lock is there on the book. So this book is a book by the great philosopher who justified the glorious revolution of 1688 and was seen as an inspiration by people like Evans. Evans deplored the Test Acts, which excluded dissenters from political power. Evans had an adopted son, who was no less than Joseph Hunter, the great Sheffield historian. And he said about his adoptive father that his opinions were extreme on the side of freedom. He was a hearty well-wisher to the French in their revolution. He had the most cordial hatred of the ministry of Mr. Pitt, the Prime Minister. This dislike was extended to the crown, so maybe George III wasn't so far wrong. And he would gladly have seen a revolution at home. And that's quite a remarkable statement. And Hunter added that many dissenting clergy and laity shared these opinions. And then the third factor making Sheffield a radical town was the cutlers, the working cutlers. They were independent-minded, well-organised, and disaffected. And this picture shows you a cutler at work. One of the things to notice is that it's quite a small workshop. It's not a huge factory like you would have found in the cotton industry in Manchester. These chaps were semi-independent, really, and if there was a big demonstration going on, they could leave their work and go on and join it. Now, what had been happening in the town in the 10 years prior to the French Revolution, in the 1780s, was a huge struggle between the working cutlers and the oligarchy which ran the cutlers' company. The working cutlers felt that the cutlers' company had betrayed them, had become far too lax in the in its regulation of the industry. It was letting too many people become apprentices and too many so-called foreigners, who were defined as anyone from outside Hallamshire, foreigners. There's still a bit of that around, isn't there? They were letting too many foreigners into the local cutlery industry. So... they were quite resourceful, these working cutlers. They actually hired lawyers and took the cutlers' company to the Court of King's Bench, but they lost the case. Now, when the news of the French Revolution reached Sheffield in 1789, it probably reached people via a newspaper called Sheffield Register, which was edited by a brilliant young man called Joseph Gales. And he, and most people in Sheffield, thoroughly welcomed the French Revolution. At last, the French were catching up with us, introducing freedom and so on. And I'm very sad that I have no picture of Gales. He's in some ways the character I find most interesting in the research I've done. The next picture shows... No, oh dear. There should be one of his... He's just trying... No, sorry. Well, okay. That's it, yeah. That is his home and his office. And it's sited very near where the Star is edited today. I mean, I think that's amazing that the newspaper, the centre of the newspaper industry is much the same place as it was in 1789. And he lived there with his very highly intelligent wife, Winifred, and their growing number of children. It's in Harpshead. He was a Unitarian, and they had their children baptised at the Upper Chapel. He was an able journalist, and he got news very quickly, remarkably quickly, from London, and put it in his newspaper, of all the amazing events that were going on. In April 1791, Gales recommended to his readers a new book, The Rights of Man, which must be one of the most influential books ever written, by Thomas Paine. Next slide, please. Yes, he would be a great precursor of humanism as well. One of the interesting things about Paine from our point of view is that in 1788 and 1789 he was in Rotherham designing an iron bridge. The whole project was a bit of a fiasco in the end, but nonetheless that's what he was doing, and my theory is that he must have met Gales at that time, because Gales would have been one of the brightest, liveliest people around the area. Now, Gales began to spread Thomas Paine's messages about democracy across the north of England. A big propaganda effort. And then a strange thing happened. There was a major riot, and the riot was about the enclosure of 6,000 acres of common land to the northwest of Sheffield. Some of you may live in the places that were on the, in places that were on this land, because I think it included Fulwood and Stannington, and it stretched right up to the moors above. Next slide. This is the vicar of Sheffield, James Wilkinson, who was there for 50 years, longer even than Joseph Evans. Very powerful figure, leading magistrate, exceedingly rich. And he pinned a notice on the church door announcing the enclosure. And the next thing he found was that he was being menaced with the greatest personal danger, he said, by a mob. And he sent a message, not by the regular stagecoach, but by some other means, to the government, and called in the light dragoons from Nottingham to restore order. But by the time the dragoons arrived, the mob had proceeded to his very grand home, Broom Hall, large part of which is still there, next slide, and set it on fire. Now, the present Dean of Sheffield Cathedral, who sees himself in some ways as a successor to Vicar Wilkinson, says of this, says of this incident, "I am on the side of the mob," he says. This is Peter Bradley. And this would be my own view. The enclosures were a shocking business, really. They enriched the rich at the expense of the poor. The Sheffield mob failed to stop the enclosure. The government installed troops in the barracks in the town, and they were there for many decades after this incident. They obviously, that was a sign of the government's worries about Sheffield. This disturbance helped to politicise the working class, and we've seen that they were arrested in an industrial sense about their situation as workers, but now they became highly political, and they founded the Sheffield Society for Constitutional Information. And historians see this as quite a momentous development. It was, according to one, the first working class organisation of any consequence in the whole country. Within 6 months, they had 2,000 members, and they promoted Paine's ideas. A lot of them were literate, and they read the Rights of Man, and they promoted Paine's ideas in all surrounding areas in a very systematic way. And similar organisations copying the Sheffield one were set up in London, Leeds and Birmingham. And Gale supported them. I think he wasn't initially a member, but became a member later. And he founded a new radical paper called The Patriot. Now, you can imagine how alarmed the government was by these new developments. It was something unprecedented. The nearest precedent was the build-up to the English Civil War. But in some ways, this was more alarming because of the efficiency with which new ideas were being propagated. The government condemned the spreading of what they called subversive doctrines, and they fostered the creation of what were called church and king parties in towns like Sheffield, and one emerged in Sheffield, and 100 people met in the Cutler's Hall. Next slide. Forget the one about the Cutler. Yeah, this slide does show me what we want here, actually. Now, over there, that is the Cutler's Hall, and that, of course, is the parish church, and in the space in between the two, a huge mob gathered, and they threatened to tear down the Cutler's Hall to stop the people in it from passing this motion in support of the king. As you know, Hartshead is not that far away. Gales was in his office and he heard a terrible commotion. And we're told that he came out without his hat. That was obviously significant, you know. He was in such a rush that he left his hat behind. And he came to where the mob was. And somebody shouted, "Mr. Gales, take the chair." And he did take the chair, and he succeeded in pacifying the crowd and getting them to disperse. And you might have thought the authorities would be very grateful for him stopping a really nasty incident, but they weren't. They saw his power over the crowd as an indication that he was a dangerous troublemaker. In February 1793, Britain entered the war against France, and the nation became patriotic and very anti-French. Thomas Paine fled to France, and Gales now was in a really highly dangerous situation, as his wife Winifred pointed out to him, and his family and relations, but he didn't really take any notice. Rather than pull back, he became more impassioned for the cause, and he chaired a public meeting on Castle Hill and launched a petition for parliamentary reform. And this petition, which was in his newspaper office for everybody to sign, it got 8,000 signatures, went to the House of Commons, who dismissed it as disrespectful. And I can't describe all the ins and outs of what happened in the ensuing months, but eventually and inevitably, in June 1794, some equivalent policemen in those days came to his office to arrest him. He was away in Derby, and he heard about this threatened arrest, and he avoided coming back to his office, and he fled to the home of somebody called Payne, maybe a relation of Thomas mm-hmm. Payne, who was a wealthy Quaker living in Wath-upon-Durn. And then he went to Hull and got a ship to Hamburg. He left behind his wife, poor old Winifred. She had four children to look after. She was actually expecting her fifth child, and she found herself responsible for a newspaper and 18 employees. It was a terrible situation for her. At first she was too proud to accept any money from anybody, but eventually she did accept money from William Shaw, who was a rich banker and the grandfather of Florence Nightingale, a Unitarian. And she sold off the newspaper and then set off with her children, got to Hull, went on a ship from Hull, went through a terrible storm and got to Hamburg, where she was reunited with Joseph. And then they went to America, where they prospered, and Gales became again a printer and a publisher, and he actually published one of Payne's books. The newspaper was taken over by Gales' able protégé, James Montgomery, aged only 23 at this time. I think this is a later, much later picture. And he renamed the paper the Iris, and he remained editor for 20 years. It was a very risky thing being an editor at that time, and he was imprisoned twice in York Castle. On the second occasion, it was because of his, what he thought, honest account of an incident where this man, who was another magistrate and a Colonel Aythorpe, had charged into a mob in Norfolk Street, or a crowd, I should say, with his sword, and later ordered his troops to fire, and they shot two people dead. He took an action of criminal libel against Montgomery. Montgomery was very ill in York Castle, and the whole experience greatly affected him, I think, and he was never a great radical ever again. But he, of course, he had a very distinguished life. He became Sheffield's most famous citizen, poet, hymn writer, philanthropist, and what's most remarkable, he looked after Gale's three sisters for the rest of their lives. They lived with him. Right, now I'm going to leap ahead to the late 1840s. In 1832, Parliament was at last reformed. Sheffield had two MPs. For the first time, it had its own MPs. The population had risen to 90,000, but only 3,500 had the vote. 3,500 voters in a population of 90,000. So you can imagine that the working classes were deeply dissatisfied. They were even more indignant when the government introduced the new harsh workhouse regime. And this is a picture of Netheredge Workhouse before, I think probably before it was built. Around 1840. Meanwhile, the Corn Laws pushed up the price of bread, and from 1837 onwards, there was a deep economic depression. And we complain about our depression today, but the effects on ordinary people in those days were of a character we can hardly imagine. And out of all these factors, in the late 1830s, emerged Chartism, which was a new national mass working class movement for democracy. And there were great Chartist rallies of up to, we're told by the local press, 20,000 people in Paradise Square. Show the next slide. Yeah, this is the slide that appears on the cover of my book. You can tell by the dress of the people that this is probably early 20th century. But it gives you an idea of how very different Sheffield was politically in those days from what it is today, that there should be meetings of this huge magnitude. And that went on really from the 1790s, certainly to the First World War, if not later. And Paradise Square, partly because of its slope, I think, it was, and maybe the acoustics were good, it was seen as a very good place to hold meetings. Going back to 1839, the Chartists drew up a national petition calling for political rights for the working classes, really. Working class men, I should say. We'll come on to the position of women later. And of course, Parliament turned it down. And then the Chartists were in a huge crisis about what to do next. And the leadership in Sheffield fell into the hands of the physical force, what was known as the Physical Force Party. The authorities banned meetings in Paradise Square, but they couldn't stop quite a lot of meetings happening. And when they bore down on meetings in the town itself, meetings were held up on Sky Edge, which was a favourite place for rebel gatherings. And beneath the surface, there were much darker designs. One of the Chartists was a young man, only 25, called Samuel Holbury. Next slide. Now, this bust, which is in Weston Park Museum, wasn't actually on show. I complained last time I went there because it wasn't on show. But it makes him look a bit more like a poet than... whereas in reality, he was a very tough ex-soldier. And a quite remarkable organiser. He was in touch with Chartist movements in lots of towns in the north. And he was planning a military insurrection. And they planned to act on the night of the 11th of January, 1840. And they would start in the outskirts of Sheffield by setting fire to the houses of the magistrates. They knew where they lived. And then they would also set fire to the barracks. They would place a bomb in the post in the police office, and they would, if they saw any magistrates riding into the centre of town, they would assassinate them. Then they would seize two key buildings. Next slide. The first was the Tontine Inn, which was in many ways the communications centre of Sheffield, where all the coaches arrived. The coaches were about to be superseded, but at this point I think the coaches were still running, so it was a very crucial place. And the other, next slide, this was the old town hall, now in a rather sad state, but then an important functioning building in the town. So the idea was that these two buildings would become Chartist forts, and they would spread the insurrection from Sheffield to other towns, and other towns would join in. What Samuel Holbury didn't know was that he had a traitor in his ranks. This was James Allen of the Station Inn in Rotherham. And he'd been persuaded by James Bland, the police chief of Rotherham, to help him, to help the police. And on that fateful day, the 11th of January, at 7 o'clock, Allen, we're told he was breathless and trembling with fear, he reported to the police chief, Bland, and to a magistrate, Lord Howard, what had been agreed at the final meeting of the conspirators. Howard jumped on his horse and galloped to the Sheffield police office, arriving there at 10 p.m. And the police and then the soldiers swung into action, and they managed to arrest Holbury and most of his colleagues just before they put their plan into operation. So it was an incredibly close-run thing, and Sheffield had missed a violent uprising just in the nick of time, thanks to Rotherham. And the precise pattern of events wasn't actually known for about 10 or 20 years. It was concealed to protect James Allen, who did eventually disappear completely. He may have been bumped off, I don't know. Very dangerous thing what he did. Holbury was given a 4-year sentence at Northallerton House of Correction. And he was badly treated, and contrary to his sentence, he was made to work on the treadmill. And he died in 1842, and his funeral procession was one of the great events of Victorian Sheffield. More than 20,000 people, we're told, lined the streets of Sheffield. And next slide. You can still see his grave in the General Cemetery. And that was the end of the last attempt that I'm aware of at a violent insurrection in Sheffield. But the story doesn't end there at Holbury, really, because in the 1970s and 80s, a famous Sheffield character, some of you probably knew, Bill Moore, and the Holbury Society, campaigned that the city should remember Holbury, and the Cascades in the Peace Gardens are dedicated to the memory of Holbury. Next slide. Here are the Cascades. So, but if someone like Holbury was around today, I fear he would be regarded as a terrorist. Anyway, food for thought. Now, the next person I want to talk to you about is Isaac Ironside, because I think you could see him as a precursor of modern humanism in a way. He dominated Sheffield radical politics in the middle of the Victorian period. He came from a poor family in Masborough, Rotherham, and they moved to Sheffield, and he became an accountant, and he amassed a considerable fortune. This is a paradox about Isaac Ironside. And yet he identified himself completely with the working class, and he worked for them unstintingly. He was a prominent speaker for the Chartists in the late 1830s, but when Holbury started to take charge and it started to become violent, he withdrew and concentrated on his greatest love, which was education. He was secretary of the Mechanics Library, but he was sacked for buying irreligious books. He was a hero. One of his characteristics, he had many strange characteristics, but one was that he was a hero worshipper. And his first hero was Robert Owen. Next slide, please. Amazing figure, historic figure, I think. An enlightened industrialist, advocate of rational socialism. And in 1839, he and Robert Owen, this is Ironside and Robert Owen, opened the Hall of Science, which was initially in Buckingham Street, and then, quite soon after, they had a purpose-built building in Rockingham Street. And it seems to have lasted for most of the Victorian period, actually. It certainly was there in the 1870s. And it had various different functions. It was partly a social centre. People could learn choral singing there. It was a secular adult education institution. And it was a kind of church for the universal community of rational religionists, of which Ironside was the local president. In 1846, Ironside and a farmer called Briggs stood as Chartists, or they called themselves Democrats, but they were by origin Chartists. and they stood for the town council. And Ironside actually represented, guess where? Ecclesall, which is not the most obvious place for Ironside to represent, but he thought it was quite amusing that he represented Ecclesall. The town council had only been founded in 1843, and so it was only 3 years old, and already it had a reputation for being a very sleepy affair, completely dominated by the Liberals. So the arrival of Ironside was quite a sensational thing for the town council. He was a great believer in conspiracy theories, so he smelt out abuses among all the power centres of the town: the councillors, the poor law guardians, the cutler's company, the church burgesses, and so on. And one after another, he targeted and accused of abuses, corruption, and so on. And he introduced bizarre resolutions in the council. One of them was that everyone in Attercliffe should be given a lollipop. Quite why he should recommend this, I don't know. In a way, he was a sort of educator. He was a bit anarchist. He didn't really like being a leader who bossed other people around at all. He often didn't vote. Most strange character, and yet incredibly dynamic. 1848, the year of revolutions in Europe. French Revolution. Great excitement in Sheffield over the French Revolution. So he leads a great meeting in Paradise Square and got the meeting to support a resolution, a communistic address to the French people. And the reforms he called for are things that have taken about 150 years to take place. One was a universal welfare state. Another one was a federation of Europe into a single republic. And the third one was, which hasn't taken place, was the taking over of all wealth by the state. It was pretty an extreme agenda, wasn't it? And he then dashed across to Paris and presented this in some way to the French Parliament. I don't know what they thought about it. He built up the Democrat Party in the council so that by 1852 he had 26 councillors out of a total of 56. And the Liberals were getting extremely jumpy by now that he was going to take over. But he had a lot of fatal flaws. He behaved so eccentrically, and he upset so many people that they started losing voters. And from that point, they went into decline. If any of you have saw the stirrings, you remember some of the incidents in that. And the one where there were two rival gas companies in Sheffield, and one lot digging holes in the ground, the other one filling them in, and all that. That was all due to Ironside. And it all ended with a huge explosion on Spittle Hill. And after that, the two rival gas companies had to be amalgamated into one. That was a typical Ironside initiative. He was, you know, the Liberal Democrats on the council just introduced community assemblies. Well, I don't think they know this, but Ironside was well ahead of them. He introduced things called ward votes in the 1840s, which were sort of community assemblies. One of his heroes was David Urquhart, who was a fanatical opponent of Tsarist Russia. And Ironside and Urquhart organised a huge demonstration in 1854 about the plight of British troops in the Crimea. And that led on to the sequence of events which actually brought down the government early the next year. So, he was an erratic genius, we might say. But if any of you know more about the Hall of Science and how it developed, I'd love to hear that. And I'm going to move on to Edward Carpenter. And you may have had talks about Edward Carpenter before, but I can't leave him out. He arrived in Sheffield in the mid-1870s. That's a picture of him. Now, if you look at his feet, he's wearing his famous sandals. It does seem to be the case that it was Edward Carpenter who introduced sandals into the UK.
Socks.
Now, I think the story of his life is fascinating. He came from a very wealthy family in Brighton. He read mathematics at Cambridge, a brilliant student, became a fellow of Trinity Hall College, also got ordained, and was curate to the famous Christian socialist F.D. Morris, who was vicar of one of the churches in Cambridge. And so there was Carpenter as a young man working with this very famous vicar who many in the church thought was a heretic. But Carpenter was extremely restless, and he repudiated all this. He was one of, I think he took advantage of new legislation which allowed you to relinquish holy orders. He left Cambridge and became a university extension lecturer in the northern towns. And he chose to live in Sheffield because, he said, he liked the heartiness and shrewdness of Sheffield people. And he sort of moved this phase in his career. He's living in various different places, one after another, including Topley. There's a tour of Topley in the off-the-shelf program, which will give some emphasis to his time in Topley, I'm sure. And then he inherited some money, and he acquired a small holding and built a home in Millthorpe in Derbyshire. And he was really famous for his simple life, and his home became a place of pilgrimage, and all sorts of socialists and mystics and strange people would arrive there, often to his dismay, because he wanted to get on with writing his next book. But he was a very kind man, so he probably never turned them away. He was a socialist, and he put his money into socialist organisations, which were very new in those days, and a little bit of money from Carpenter made a lot of difference. The 1880s were a time of terrible hardship in Sheffield, and here you see people queuing up for some money from a committee of good people who are handing out money. Carpenter and a small band of colleagues, most of whom were working men, remarkable working men, set up the Sheffield Socialist Society. And here they are. And this is Carpenter here. I don't know whether anybody knows who all the other people are. It would be wonderful to know. They used to hold meetings at, next slide, at the Monolith. This is just near where the town hall now is, in fact. And the big tower or spire on the right is St. Paul's Church, which is where the Peace Gardens now are. And the Monolith was a good place for somebody could stand on the step and hold forth to the crowd. The Socialist Society founded a cafe called the Commonwealth Cafe, which was in Scotland Street, a very poor area. And for a whole winter, I think, Carpenter slept in the attic above the cafe. Carpenter's socialism was very different from that of Marx, Lenin, or Stalin. he was in some ways like Ironside, in a way, more of an anarchist than a socialist, and he called for freedom and fulfilment in human relationships. He certainly wasn't in favour of a very powerful state. He wrote to his friends about something he called the SR, which was the Socialist Revolution, but it was all rather vague. One of his most interesting enigmatic writings is a poem called Towards Democracy, and in that he wrote, "I conceive a millennium on earth, a time when men and women all over the earth shall ascend and enter into relation with their bodies, shall attain freedom and joy." Now, this reference to people entering into relation with their bodies is really significant. Carpenter was one of a tiny handful of people at that time writing about sexual liberation at a time of extreme prudishness. And his books sold very widely. A lot of them were translated abroad. Then he became forgotten to a considerable extent, not in Sheffield, but in the country as a whole, until he was rediscovered in the 1960s. A very good new biography by Sheila Rowbottom, who's speaking at Off the Shelf. He was himself homosexual, and he lived openly in Millthorpe with George Merrill. And he wrote about the stifling social restrictions on the life of women, and he, in a way, was one of the leading thinkers behind the women's suffrage movement, which I'm going to move on to now. Sheffield was very important in the movement for women's suffrage. In fact, the very first organisation of women for women's suffrage was founded in Sheffield in 1851. It was the Sheffield Female Political Association, and it emerged partly from the Chartists, from women Chartists, and sadly it fizzled out. In the 20th century, as you can imagine, the women's suffrage movement was very split between moderates and militants. And Adela Pankhurst was local leader of the militants in Sheffield. She was one of the daughters of the famous Emmeline Pankhurst. She was a small, slim girl, but incredibly courageous and an impassioned open-air speaker. She got physically attacked quite often by large rugger playing young men and so on. Quite extraordinary what went on. And she was not put off by that. She kept working hard for the cause. In October 1908, the First Lord of the Admiralty, Reginald McKenna, came to Sheffield to address a banquet at the Cutler's Hall, and all the leading industrialists were agog to hear what McKenna was going to say about orders for the Navy, which was what they were interested in. Adela's agenda was totally different, and she dressed up as a kitchen maid in order to try and get inside the Cutler's Hall and disturb the occasion. She addressed a crowd of 800 people outside the town hall and shouted, "I am going in!" And the crowd replied, "We are going with you." And they marched to the Cutler's Hall. You know, it's not very far, is it? And there they found there was a police corps. And she said, "I am going to see Mr. McKenna." And the chief inspector replied, "Oh, no, you are not." And she then withdrew and disappeared, went to her hotel, and changed her clothes, and then came back and tried to get in there again, but I'm afraid she was again unsuccessful. But this is just one of many exploits. The next slide. And her successor as a militant organiser was Molly Morris. And she did even more dangerous and dubious work. She put letter bombs into post boxes. And one day, she put her bomb into the postbox in Surrey Street, and smoke belched out, and the car backfired at the same time. And so there was a bang, and everybody was very alarmed. A crowd gathered, so she quietly joined the crowd. And then a policeman recognised her and came up to her and said, we know it's the London lot what do these things, Miss Morris, and not you young ladies. I wish all your people were like you. It would make our job so much easier. So Molly kept very quiet because she had several more letter bombs in her handbag. She had an office and a shop in Chapel Walk, and as you can see, she was a very pretty young woman. And young men used to hang around the shop, and we're told that the ladies from Fulwood on her committee protested about all these men hanging around this shop. And poor old Molly lost her job. Apparently letter bombs were okay, but boyfriends were not. The suffragettes didn't work in vain. After the war, as you know, the women did get the vote. And by 1929, there were all these women councillors in the Labour Party. So that's quite a breakthrough compared with the situation in the days of Adela Pankhurst and Molly Morris. Now, just looking at the time, I think I'm right, am I? Yes. Just a bit about Labour and Sheffield. Next slide. Yeah, Karl Marx never came to Sheffield. He did write articles for the Sheffield Free Press, and he was very annoyed with Isaac Ironside, who failed to pay his fee. And Marx wrote to Engels, "Money is the only interesting point for me in my intercourse with these Calibans." So that's the only comment I know of that Marx made about Sheffield. he had some important followers, notably J.T. Murphy from Winkerbank, and he was a shop steward who led an amazing strike in the First World War, which was immediately successful. After the war, he went to see Lenin in Moscow, and Lenin obviously saw him as potential leader of a revolution in Britain, and spent long time with Lenin. He married Molly Morris, and she came to see Lenin as well. He joined the Comintern. He actually moved the expulsion of Trotsky from the party. And here he is. This is members of the Comintern outside Lenin's tomb. And apart from Stalin and Murphy and Murphy's son, who now lives in Canada, I think nearly all the others were exterminated by Stalin in the 1930s. So it's a rather sad picture. Going back to Sheffield Labour Party, it was an uphill struggle for Sheffield, for the Labour Party in Sheffield. They had an MP, next slide, Joseph Poynter, in 1909, MP for Attercliffe, former Wesleyan Reform Minister. But right up to 1914, they had very few councillors. And the situation changed, next slide, when this man started to lead them, Ernest George Rowlandson, immensely skillful local party leader. And the Conservatives and Liberals made a complete hash of things after the First World War, and they formed an alliance called the Citizens' Party, with no programme except to keep Labour out. And they had nothing to offer the working class, who were a huge majority in the town. Then the general strike took place. Sheffield very strongly in favour of the general strike, apart from some of the sort of industrialists, obviously. And 6 months after the strike, there was a municipal election which Labour won. And next slide. That's a scene during the general strike in Fitzalan Square, a very dramatic photo from the Star. Next slide. And that is the victorious Labour councillors who took power in the end of 1926. And now just a few words about the 1980s. I can't deal with it, the period, properly. Many of you will remember the 1980s. Labour had definitely shifted to the left and rejoiced in the title of Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire. Next slide. The red flag was raised over the town hall. It's a rare picture from my friend John Baxter. Holbury was commemorated, as we've seen in the Peace Gardens. There was a series of Marx memorial lectures. Meanwhile, of course, the great industries of Sheffield were in free fall. Next slide. Mrs. Thatcher was extremely unpopular. This was a poster for the occasion when she came to speak at the Cutlass Hall, and she had to be protected by 1,000 policemen. Rather like the 1790s, Sheffield was trying to follow its own agenda and trying to say to Westminster, we'd rather do it our way. And of course they were defeated. In 1985 was really the turning point. The government defeated the miners and defeated Sheffield City Council over rate capping. And Blunkett and his colleagues had to back off. And from that point on, you see a shift going on in the Labour movement towards what was first called New Realism and then New Labour. What is Sheffield's radical tradition about? And here I draw on the ideas of Sidney Pollard, Professor of Economic History in the University of Sheffield. He came to England as part of the Kinder transport in 1938 from Vienna as a child. Next slide. And this is what he said, that he's talking about the whole of South Yorkshire, which Sheffield's the leading city, of course. And the things he brought out were independence of spirit, defence of the weak against the strong, and opposition to central authority as against the region. And he thought these were strong characteristics of this area, and I think they're values that we should cherish and build on in the future. Thank you.